One of the most fascinating and inspirational books of the Bible is that of Daniel. No modern literature provides such interesting narrative, nor portrays a nobler hero. And in addition to the sheer excitement of its adventure, the book contains lessons of the highest precept. It is full of lessons and examples of sublime faith, loyalty, courage, integrity, and complete and absolute devotion to God. It also contains prophecies of tremendous and worldwide importance, presented in the most dramatic manner. Those prophecies which have been fulfilled are seen by Bible students to have been precisely accurate, and those in the process of fulfillment or unfulfilled are the subject of intense interest and anticipation by those acquainted with God's plan. The book of Daniel was given for us, the last members of the body of Christ, right now. How do we know? Because we are now living in that period of history known as the time of the end. We are living in the end of the age, the end of the gospel age, and the beginning of the millennial age. And we read in Daniel 12, 9 and 10, the words of the Lord, "And he said, Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." So today we're going to consider a small portion of the book of Daniel and see what lessons it has for us. We read in the first chapter that in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. This was some 20 years before the final destruction of Jerusalem, and Nebuchadnezzar took many captives to Babylon at this time. This was the first captivity, and included the very cream of the Jewish nation. We read, "And the king, Nebuchadnezzar, spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, and skillful in all wisdom, and cunning in knowledge, and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand before the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. These are very high and exacting qualifications which the king Nebuchadnezzar had set." And Ashpenaz obeyed him, selecting a considerable number of the very elite of the nation. And it is written, "Now among these were the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah." At this time, Daniel was 14 years old, and the others were probably about the same age. We immediately begin to wonder how a 14-year-old boy could possibly meet the qualifications which had been set: skillful in all wisdom and cunning in knowledge and understanding science. I think it is obvious that this refers to some sort of qualifying test which was applied, similar to our modern IQ test, in order to make the selections. It was a sort of aptitude test which would indicate a person's capacity or potential, whether a person would be skillful in learning wisdom, or cunning in absorbing knowledge, or logical enough to understand science if these things were taught to him. And these boys were also tested for what we would today call the quality of poise. This is indicated by the requirement, "and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace." After all, Nebuchadnezzar ruled the world with force and was greatly feared. Incurring his slightest displeasure was death. It is said of him in Daniel 5:19, "All the people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew; whom he would, he kept alive; and whom he would, he set up; and whom he would, he put down." For one to stand calmly before such a fearsome monarch and his court required a high degree of self-assurance, which in the case of Daniel and his companions was based upon faith in God. We know that they were children of godly, reverential parents because of their names. The name Daniel means God is my judge. Hananiah means Jehovah is gracious, or Jehovah has favored. Mishael means godlike. Azariah means Jehovah has helped, or the help of Jehovah. This clearly denotes a God-fearing parentage and upbringing. Today we would say that they were born and raised in the truth. By common consent, Danielson seems to have been the leader and spokesman of the Hebrew boys who had thus been selected for special training in the court of the king of Babylon. It was a sort of royal university, the faculty being composed of the wisest men of the realm. It was a 3-year course, at the completion of which the king himself would give them the examination. And from this graduating class, the king would draw his assistants and counselors of state for the rulership of the universal empire of Babylon. What a wonderful opportunity. While studying, they would be treated as members of the royal household. So we read, and the king appointed them a daily portion of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now let us contrast for a moment the condition of Daniel and his companions before their captivity and after their captivity. In Jerusalem, reared by godly Hebrew parents, strictly trained in the law and the statutes, they led a sheltered and blameless existence. Suddenly, they found themselves among the worst of the heathen, where the Hebrew law was totally ignored, where might made right, where moral standards did not exist, where strange and cruel gods were worshipped instead of Jehovah. And they were in the household of the king, favored by him and obligated to him for their well-being and future prospects. And they were young and away from parental and religious control. Now, wouldn't it have been perfectly natural under these circumstances for them to adopt the ways and customs of their heathen hosts, to lower their standards, to become careless in their conduct, to say to themselves, what's the difference? Who will know? Surely we mustn't offend our benefactors by being too different from them. When in Rome, do as the Romans do, or more accurately, when in Babylon, do as the Babylonians do. It would have been quite natural, but these young Hebrews were unusual persons. They did not take the lax and easy way, the natural way. So in the very beginning, a crisis arose because of their determination to remain faithful to the law of their God. We read, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. The food provided for these college students was good, probably far better and more varied than they had been used to previously. But Israelites, under their law covenant, were forbidden to eat certain foods which were in common use among the other nations. For example, pork, rabbit flesh, eels, oysters, etc., were not permitted. Other meats had to be slaughtered in a certain manner in order to eliminate the blood. And there were other regulations regarding the manner of food preparation and combination. If these statutes of the law were violated, the person was considered defiled. Even at this youthful age, and in spite of the temptation to eat exotic foods which were probably most delicious, Daniel was determined to adhere to the law of his God. So instead of the king's food, he requested that they be supplied pulse to eat, and instead of wine, water to drink. Pulse is a term applied to legumes, such as peas, beans, and lentils, and perhaps certain grains. The prince of the eunuchs objected, fearing the Hebrew boys would appear undernourished, and that he would be held responsible for it. But after a 10-day trial, the young Hebrews were found to be in better condition than those who partook of the king's food. So they were allowed to continue on their plain but wholesome diet. Daniel's determination not to be defiled with certain food reminds us of the words of the apostle in 1 Corinthians 3:17. If any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy. In one sense of the word, the temple of God is his church. This is borne out by 1 Peter 2:5. He also, as living stones, are built up a spiritual house. So there is a powerful lesson to be learned here. This lesson is brought out by Pastor Russell's comments on Daniel's attitude regarding defiling food. It is found on page 3631 of the reprints from which I quote. Whoever introduces into the church that which is defiling, whoever does injury to any of its living stones, is an evildoer in the highest sense of that term, in that he is defiling and injuring the body of Christ, which is the church. If all could realize this, how careful all would be in respect to the bringing in of different errors and false doctrines, misinterpretations of scriptures, etc. How careful each then would be to see that he speaks the things which he does know, that he would confine himself to the things written in the word of the Lord. In proportion as those who are right at heart see this, they will be careful that they do nothing to defile or stumble or injure any of the Lord's little ones. End of quotation. How accurately Brother Russell described what would happen. He was a very wise man. After his departure, evildoers did indeed arise, using Brother Russell's own publishing facilities to introduce false doctrines which stumbled thousands. Many precious truths revealed by our returned Lord were repudiated and replaced by erroneous doctrines which upset and did violence to the plan. Old, well-proven, and precious truths were rudely pushed aside and replaced by so-called new light. By contrived translations and cunning misinterpretations of scriptures, the faith of many of the Lord's little ones was overthrown. Those responsible were indeed, in the language of Brother Russell, evildoers in the highest sense of that term. Because Jesus himself said in Matthew 18:6, "But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believeth in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depths of the sea." God grant it does not happen again. And there is another and more important lesson regarding the food of Daniel and his companions. It was plain but nourishing food. The truth is like that. The truth is not complicated. In its purity, it is plain and simple and satisfying. Some needlessly complicate the truth. This causes confusion and sometimes division. Babylon means confusion. As Daniel and his companions shunned the exotic and enticing foods of Babylon, the Lord's people will shun confusing doctrines, old and new. The structure of the truth is a finely balanced building, one structural member depending upon another for support. Take out one piece or alter its shape, and the structure no longer balances. The other pieces no longer fit. So if we deny even one essential and well-established doctrine or alter its meaning, even a seemingly unimportant one, we destroy the symmetry and harmony of the truth. We read of Daniel and his companions, after they had eaten simple and wholesome food for 10 days, and at the end of 10 days their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. The plain, clean, unadulterated truth agrees with us. It makes us serene and confident, no matter what transpires on the earth. There can be no surprises for us. Why? because we know the plan and our place and part in it. And this knowledge should show. As with Daniel and his companions, it should show in our countenances. The difference should be noticed. The world is in a state of wild-eyed fear, described in Luke 21, 25, and 26. Upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity. The sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. But our condition is described in Psalm 46, 1 to 3. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. So knowledge of the pure, plain, wholesome truth should show in our faces and be reflected in our spirits and attitudes and should daily influence the way we conduct ourselves. Daniel and his companions were conscientious in their studies. We read of them in the 17th verse. As for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. We are not to understand that this skill and learning was wholly miraculous. The gift of understanding visions and dreams was, of course, miraculous, but only Daniel had this gift. As to the general knowledge and skill they achieved, this was a natural result of aptitude combined with conscientious effort. Don't forget that these were boys who had the strength of character to impose self-denial for righteousness' sake. This showed the stuff they were made of. We would expect them to have courage and strength of character in other matters also, including their studies. Their determination in the matter of their food, showing that they would rather deny themselves and violate God's law, is very revealing. It indicates a mental and moral discipline. It attributes that which would be helpful in all affairs of life. And there is a lesson in this for every Christian. Many are inclined to think of the little things of life as unimportant. But it is a fact that proficiency cannot be attained in any department of life without determined willpower. And it is equally true that we cannot show strength and willpower in important things if we are lax and pliable in the small things of life. Applying this rule to Christians, he who wants to be an overcomer at all must make the effort all along the line, on every point, great or small, where conscience and principle are involved. This is brought out by Luke 16:10. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. The three-year course of study was finally finished. We read, now at the end of the days that the king had said he would bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. This is somewhat astonishing when we remember the ages of Daniel and his companions. They were now only about 17, and in wisdom and understanding were 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers of Babylon. It reminds me of Paul's admonition to young Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:12, Diaglot. Let no one despise thy youth, but become a pattern of the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in purity. We are in a condition very similar to that of Daniel and his companions, and our prospects are similar. As they found themselves captive in a strange land, we are strangers and pilgrims in the earth. We are in the world, but not of the world. And as they were enrolled in the Royal College, we are in the School of Christ. They were selected for their special schooling because certain potentialities were seen in them. Similarly, before the Father draws us to Christ, he sees potentialities in us. Rough and poor though our exteriors may be, God looketh on the heart. And he never calls one for enrollment in the School of Christ in preparation for the high calling unless he sees in that person the ability to make his calling and election sure with God's help. This should be very encouraging to us. As Daniel and his companions were being fitted for positions of rulership in the kingdom, we are being prepared to reign with Christ. As they learned all the wisdom of the Chaldeans, we, in the language of 2 Timothy 3:16, are made wise unto salvation. When their course of study was ended, Daniel and his companions were brought before the king, and the king communed with them and was satisfied with their attainments. As for us, when our course is ended, we will appear before the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Our head, Jesus Christ, will present us to God the Father. As Jude 24 and 25 expresses it, "Now unto him that is able to keep you from falling, and to present you faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy. To the only wise God, our Savior, be glory and majesty, dominion and power, both now and forever." And our great King will commune with us too. We shall see him face to face and hear his "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." What a thrilling and joyful experience that will be. And it is not too far distant for some of us. In the words of Psalm 17:15, "As for me, I will behold thy face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness." Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, children of Judah, were now members of a very elite group. Not only were they considered on par with the group described as the magicians and astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans, but they, together with many other graduates of the Royal College, formed a sort of executive pool, a pool of talent from which would be appointed magistrates, administrators, and rulers over the provinces of the expanding Babylonian Empire. But they were very young. And even though the king had declared them to be 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers in all matters of wisdom and understanding, it would be only natural that those of more mature age would be first selected. It would be a matter of seniority, so it might take years for their turns to come. But the Lord had plans for them in Babylon. He had work for them to do, especially Daniel. So he did not wait for the normal course of promotion to leisurely operate. He intervened. He speeded things up. It is always true that where the Lord's people and his service are concerned, the principle of Psalm 75:6-7 applies. "For promotion cometh neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south. But God is the judge. He putteth down one and setteth up another." The Lord performed his promotion of Daniel and his companions directly through Nebuchadnezzar the king. Although Nebuchadnezzar was a mighty and willful monarch, conqueror and ruler of the world, the Lord maneuvered him with the greatest of ease to perform his will. And at the same time, by this very same occasion, he caused to be recorded an astonishing prophecy, a prophecy presented in the most spectacular manner, covering tremendous events, extending from the time it was given until the time of Christ's kingdom. A prophecy which has proven so precisely accurate in its fulfilled portions as to leave no room for doubt that the God of heaven rules in the affairs of men, and indeed has a divine plan for the ages. The account is in the 2nd chapter of Daniel. King Nebuchadnezzar had retired for the night. It was only natural that affairs of state would crowd his thoughts. matters pertaining to his growing empire. Then his thoughts ran to the probabilities of his empire long enduring, and he began to wonder what the future held for him and his kingdom. All this we know from what happened afterwards. The king fell asleep and began to dream. His dreams were at first disconnected and confused. Then suddenly there burst upon his inner vision a bright and terrible apparition, a dream so vivid and menacing as to bring him instantly awake, trembling with fear. This was no ordinary dream. He had never had one like this before. He knew without a doubt that this dream must have a special and important significance. He arose from his bed and struck a gong. His servants ran in, and he commanded them to immediately summon the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans, so that they might tell him the meaning of his dream. We can imagine that he paced the floor, impatiently waiting for his wise men to arrive. Then he stopped short. A strange thing had happened. He could not recall his dream. So vivid and clear in his mind just a few moments before, it had now completely vanished from his memory, leaving behind a sinister and disturbing void, which only added to his terror. When the wise men arrived, the king was in a desperate frame of mind. So they came and stood before the king, the account says. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king was frantic. The thing is gone from me, he said. But you must tell me what it was and give me the meaning of it at once. This is very important. He looked from one to another of his wise men and saw the blankness of their faces. I tell you, the thing is gone from me, he said. Then in his anger he threatened them. If ye will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. But it didn't help. They just didn't know. They hung their heads. The king changed his tactics. Now he almost pleaded with them. But if ye show the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. But the wise men still insisted that the king must first tell his dream to them. Then Nebuchadnezzar lost all patience. He accused them of stalling, of trying to gain time, and of being ready to lie to him and to give him a false interpretation. There is but one decree for you, he shouted. Ye shall be cut in pieces. Realizing they were caught in a hopeless situation and doomed, the spokesman for the wise men said to the king, There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, or ruler that asks such things of any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. This was a polite way of saying, Your Majesty, you are being very unreasonable. Then we read, For this cause the king was angry and very furious, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And let us not forget that Daniel and his three companions, although they were not then present, were now numbered with the wise men of Babylon. At this juncture, it looked like a serious calamity for them, instead of a step toward advancement. Without any fault on their part, they had been condemned to death. We read, And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. Arioch, captain of the king's guard, was ordered to perform the executions. But he was friendly to Daniel and warned him. We read from the account, then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. The magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans were called wise men, and they were after the wisdom of this world. But Daniel reacted with true wisdom. We read, then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they should desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret. Then Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. What did they do? They had a prayer meeting. I picture them on their knees, the four of them, in a circle, clasping each other's hands, together laying the matter before the Lord. They probably took turns praying aloud. What did they say? I imagine they addressed the Lord as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Israel, the God of their fathers. They probably recounted, each one of them, all the Lord's providences on their behalf up to that very time, giving thanks for them. Then I think they must have pleaded God's glory, saying in effect, the King Nebuchadnezzar and all of his court know that we worship thee, the only true God, the God of Israel. We have kept thy statutes even here in this heathen land before them all. They worship other gods who really are not gods at all. Now, if you permit us to be slain together with these heathen magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, and Chaldeans, men will say of us, they trusted in the God of the Hebrews, but their God was not strong enough to save them from the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. They will say this of you, the creator of heaven and earth. Therefore, for thy name's sake, tell us the king's secret and deliver us out of his hand. After this, they went to bed and calmly went to sleep. Now we read from the account. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me now what we desired of thee, for thou hast made known unto us the king's matter. Isn't that a wonderful song of praise? Do you hear the exultation in it? The adoration? The heart overflowing with thankfulness and love? No wonder the angel of the Lord on a later occasion three times referred to Daniel as a man greatly beloved. It is a wonderful thing to be greatly beloved of the Lord. Daniel hurried to Arioch, captain of the king's guard, and said, destroy not the walls, men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste, and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah, who will make known unto the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen, and the interpretation thereof? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king hath demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, cannot show unto the king. But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets, and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thus Daniel gave the full credit to God, and modestly disclaimed any special wisdom of his own, saying, but as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living. Then Daniel related the dream to Nebuchadnezzar, and as Daniel talked, the king's memory returned with stunning force. vividly corroborating every fascinating detail of the dream he saw that night. He trembled as the description poured from Daniel's lips. Thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest still that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet, that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. The king was too overcome to say anything, but it was evident from his face that his dream had been accurately described. Daniel continued, "This is a dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given unto thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold." Then Daniel went on to say that the image's breast and arms of silver represented another and inferior kingdom, which would in time succeed Babylon, which Bible students know was the universal empire of Medo-Persia. Then he said there would arise a third kingdom, represented by the brass part of the image, which we know was Greece, which succeeded Medo-Persia. Then Daniel described a fourth, very strong kingdom, represented by the iron legs and feet parts of the image, which we can identify as the Roman Empire and its remnant kingdoms now upon the earth. Then Daniel gave the grand climax of the prophecy, the complete fulfillment of which is still future, but which is now in progress. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. This kingdom has been set up. And the kingdom shall not be left to other nations, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it break in pieces the iron and the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God of heaven hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. And the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. The record continues, "Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel." How quickly the situation had changed. A few minutes before, this king sat upon his throne in regal splendor, a powerful monarch with the world in his hands, angry and vengeful, ordering the deaths of the wisest men of the realm. And now, a few minutes later, that same king lay prone, fallen upon his face. Do you see how easily the Lord maneuvers and manipulates even the mightiest king in the world? Do you see how easy it is for him to intervene to accomplish his will on behalf of his people? We read, "The king said unto Daniel, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldst reveal this secret. Then the king made Daniel a great man, and gave him many great gifts, and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. And at Daniel's request, his three companions, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, were raised to positions of great power, being set over the affairs of the province of Babylon." Now let us consider a lesson. When the Lord first put into motion a series of events leading to the promotion of Daniel and his companions, There was a time when things looked extremely black. They had been condemned to death without fault and without recourse. The Lord's hand seemed to be against them. But they did not yield to discouragement and despair. They took it to the Lord in prayer. And having done so, they left the matter in the Lord's hands. Sometimes we may have discouraging and despairing experiences, times when our very existence as new creatures seems to be threatened, when our service to the Lord appears to be at an end. At such times, let us remember that as in the case of Daniel and his companions, the Lord may permit us to be brought low just before he exalts us. That the humbling experiences are necessary for our advancement. So let us react as Daniel and his companions did, which is expressed in 1 Peter 5, 6, and 7. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. And when the crisis is over, when the Lord has seen us through our trying experience, let us, like Daniel, be quick to thank and praise the Lord for his goodness to us. And the Lord, seeing a heart condition similar to Daniel's, will also call us greatly beloved. He does so through Paul, who said in Philippians 4:1, my brethren, dearly beloved, and longed for, my joy and crown, so stand fast in the Lord, dearly beloved.